Well, hi, everyone. I hope your holidays were amazing. And wherever you're joining us from today, from your living room on TV or from your office computer, your iPhone or iPad, wherever you might be today, I want to thank you for joining us. And we have people watching from Erie, Pennsylvania, which is where we're physically located. But we have people joining us today from all over the country and all over the world. And I want to welcome you in the name of Jesus. Some of you were able to share in our Christmas Eve experience and were inspired and motivated to make church a priority in this new year. And I think that's an awesome goal. And so, you know, let's do it together, okay? Every year at Christmas, I do for our family kind of this year-end review photo book, you know, and I pull all the highlight photos from the previous year from all of our phones, and I put them together into a little coffee table book. And this year, when I went back to those first pictures from 2020, exactly 1 year ago last January, it was shocking. It felt like a lifetime ago. 2020 has been a long and brutal year. And we may have never anticipated a new year so much as when the clock struck midnight on 2021. And as I looked at those pictures, I kept thinking, Derek, you had no idea what was coming. And I wondered, actually, what I could have done differently to prepare in advance for the events of 2020. How could I have gotten more ready mentally and emotionally and physically for what this year has brought? And the truth is, none of us knows what the next year will bring. And so our best option on this first weekend of 2021 is to reset. It's to get our feet firmly planted, our eyes firmly fixed, and our hearts firmly committed to what matters most. And that is our relationship with God. Like if that's rock solid, everything else is rock solid, no matter what may come. So we're starting a new sermon series this month called On God, Life, and Love, where we'll look at key decisions and relationships that will set us up for an amazing year in 2021. Now, every year, about 130 million Americans make a New Year's resolution. They say, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to eat better, I'm going to stop procrastinating, I'm going to take my wife on more dates, I'm going to look at social media less, I'm going to read more books, whatever it may be. Now, do you know how many people actually follow through on these resolutions? 8%. 8% of people actually do what they set out to do. So why can't they follow through? It's because I think in most cases, the habits that people try to form are external habits. They're not transformative from the inside. And I believe that there's only one truly transformative practice that has the potential to impact all the other areas of life. And that's what I want to talk about today. So here's my big idea. It's that true life change flows from life-giving spiritual disciplines. Now, that word discipline can freak people out because it sounds like the same thing as when you used to take that horrible medicine. Remember when you plugged your nose and you stuck the spoon in because you knew it would taste horrible, but it would be good for you eventually. But I don't want us to think of disciplines that way. I don't want us to be afraid of disciplines. Disciplines are simply practices that you put into place to get from where you are to where you want to be. They're baby steps that are going to get you to a big step. And I'm convinced that deep down, most of us want to take a big spiritual step this year. The Bible talks again and again about this idea of transformation. It says, take off the old self and put on the new self. It says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It says, this Greek word that it's using each of these cases is metamorphe. It's where we get the word metamorphosis. It's when something undergoes a change, a metamorphosis, and it leaves nothing the same as it was. And so if you weren't familiar with the process of metamorphosis and you saw a little caterpillar hanging from a branch, you would never dream that one day that little thing would fly. It's the most counterintuitive of all processes. It's crazy. You could never imagine that naked little worm would be flying through the sky with beautiful wings. How can anything so lowly eventually fly? The answer, metamorphosis. It's what you and I are called to. We can change. And I don't care what a lowly worm you feel like today. I don't care what mess you're in. You were meant to fly. You were meant to soar. You were meant to do greater things and see a greater perspective because transformation is possible. Metamorphosis, life change is possible. Now, the most important kind of step one of any kind of life change is to first clarify the goal. And so I would just ask at the beginning here, what is the goal of life? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Like, what's the goal of my life? What am I about? What am I doing here with my days? And I think if I could zoom us all into one big call, like everyone who's watching right now, and just went around the call and asked you to answer that question, I think we'd get radically different answers. Some of you would say, you know, it's to be as successful as I can be, or maybe it's to leave a positive mark on the world or raise great kids. And those are just the spoken answers. There may be some that you actually think, but are too cringy to say out loud. Like, what I really want to do is to make a crap ton of money. Or to like climb to the top of my company, or to be as physically attractive as possible for as long as possible. But it's important to ask and answer the question, what's my goal? One of Covey's seven habits is to begin with the end in mind. And so I want to suggest today that if you're operating from a Christian worldview, that there's one goal for this life. For the Christian, the goal of life is to be more like Jesus, plain and simple. In fact, the whole mission statement of our church is built around this concept. We say around here that the mission of Grace Church is to make and to be fully devoted followers of Jesus. We want to follow him in everything that he says and does. And guys, it's because his image and his spirit are already inside us, and we simply have to live that out. I don't know if any of you have curious or inquisitive kids, but my wife Kim and I have lived through this with our three. They asked so many questions. Our oldest son, Caleb, who's now 23, he pushed me to have the birds and the bees conversation much sooner than I was ready for because of his curiosity. Here's how it went. He said this, and this is kind of deep thinking. He said, "Dad, people tell me all the time that I look like you, but I know that I came out of mom. Now, if mom had never met you, and she was married to someone else, and she had me, would I still look like you even though she had never met you?" Now, those are deep thoughts for a little kid. I said, "Well, no, you know, I'm trying to avoid imposture. No, you look like me because, well, mom and I together made you." He said, "Well, I thought I came out of mom, and I didn't come out of you. So how did you get your looks into mom?" Caleb and I didn't stop the conversation there, but you and I are going to stop it right there. But my point is this, that there's a family resemblance, and that there's the reason that he looks like me is because he came from me. And in the same way, we were made in the image and the likeness of God. He's in us. And the goal of our lives then is to reflect his image to the world. The Bible reaffirms this over and over again through every stage of the scriptures. It says things like you were created, you know, to be like Jesus. In fact, Romans 8:29 says that for those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to what? The image of his son. We were created to be more and more like Jesus. This passage says that we were to be conformed to his image, which means a replica. Guys, the word Christian literally means little Christ, which means when people look at you, they should see Jesus. This is what we were created for. But not only that, you are destined to be like Jesus in the end. So there's a passage that tells us what will happen at the end of time, at the second coming of Jesus. And this is the whole goal that our lives have been building toward. Listen to 1 John 3:2-3. It says this, "But we know that when he appears, we shall be," what? "Like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure." Did you hear that? Your whole life is building in a crescendo to be like Jesus. Now, that sounds a little overwhelming, especially for those of us who feel like failures on most days. I mean, when I'm in the middle of being frustrated because the Wi-Fi is running too slow, being like Jesus feels like kind of a pretty high bar, amen? So if we're created to be like Jesus, but in reality we're idiots, how do we get from here to there? Well, step two is this, it's to create a plan to be more like Jesus. We don't stumble into Christ's likeness, and so we have to create a plan by being intentional about this relationship. And so this relationship with God is just like any other significant endeavor that we might chase in our lifetime, like running a marathon or becoming a surgeon or learning how to play the piano. If that's the goal, there needs to be a plan in place, smaller steps, to reach that goal. And here's what a plan will do. A spiritual plan allows you to arrange your life around those practices that will connect you to Jesus and live more and more like him. Like if you arrange your life around certain spiritual practices, you will begin to see real change happening. You'll begin to find that in those moments of decision, that you're going to have the strength and the courage beyond yourself to do the right things. These practices have historically been called the spiritual disciplines. Now, this word discipline actually comes from the same root word as the word disciple. The concepts are closely connected. Some of you have experienced disciplines, and you've experienced them in the form of dead religion in the past, and you've maybe have a bad taste in your mouth about these disciplines. Like you went through them as kind of going through the motions, just doing rote prayers or not eating certain foods on certain days, and you're like, it all seems so random and pointless. Well, I want us to reclaim and reinvigorate our idea of spiritual disciplines. Think of them not as tasks to check off a list, but as relationship builders. These are ways to infuse your relationship with God with life and energy. In the same way you would do, you know, regular date nights with your spouse or girls' night out with your friends or donuts with your kids on Friday morning, whatever. Any love relationship takes this kind of intentionality, and so does life change. So spiritual disciplines are just our way of being intentional about our relationship with God and becoming more and more like Jesus. But what are these disciplines? And how can we embrace them as we head into 2021? Well, I want to take a kind of non-traditional approach, and I want to summarize them with the aim of helping us to become more like Jesus. And so I just want to look at kind of some overarching ideas. We're going to look at three life-changing disciplines, and I'm going to kind of add a declaration with each one. So here's the first. It's the discipline of exploration. And it just says, I will investigate the ways of Jesus. So if our goal is to be more like Jesus, one of the huge first prerequisites is to find out all we can about him. And I think one of the easiest and most basic ways to investigate the ways of Jesus, to practice the discipline of exploration, is to start your week with church. Not so that you can check off a box in your regular efforts to try to impress God, but so that you can truly investigate who he is and what he's like. And so one important step that many of you can take in 2021 is to prioritize church, to watch online, to attend in person someday soon, we hope, but to get it in your schedule. And if you have even the vaguest interest in spiritual vitality, someone who, you know, you want to be someone who knows God a little bit more or feels their faith a little bit more deeply or has a little bit more clarity on God's direction for your life, then church is certainly something that you should have on your calendar every week. I'm truly amazed at the number of people who are still kind of flipping coins every Sunday morning. Should we do church or shouldn't we do church? Like, do we have more important things this week? Guys, the time for flipping coins on Sunday mornings needs to be a thing of the past if you're committed to the discipline of exploration. I like how the Gospels say it about Jesus. Luke 4:16 says, and on the Sabbath day, Jesus went to the synagogue, listen, as was his custom. Like, it was on his calendar. Every week he was gathering with other believers for worship. But there's another way to explore the ways of Jesus, and that's simply to read your Bible. There's one pretty solid source of information on Jesus, and it's called the Bible. Now, for those of you who may be new to the Bible, the first four books of the New Testament are called the Gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're basically the biography of the life of Jesus from four authors' perspectives. Luke or John would be a great place to start reading. But if you're brand new to the Bible, listen, I don't necessarily recommend starting at the very beginning and just plowing through. Start with Luke or John. Speaking of the beginning, the Old Testament is the story of Israel and really the story of history that points us all to Jesus. It was the prequel, if you will, of the life of Christ in God's story. And then after the Gospels, the rest of the New Testament is like the sequel, the ripple effects of Jesus' life. It's the story of how the disciples of Jesus took the news of his life and death to the world. So they started a church in Jerusalem and then churches all over the region in the Middle East. And then they began communicating with those churches by letter, which makes up most of the material in the New Testament. These are historically verifiable examples of lives that were changed by God in the flesh named Jesus. And I understand that the Bible can be intimidating. It's a big book, sometimes confusing. Not everyone is a reader, all that. I get it all. But it has been proven in survey after survey that the key to spiritual growth is reading and then reflecting on the truth of the Bible. It has a transformative effect. And around here, we've adopted this phrase called find your chair. And what that means is just every day, or as often as possible, find that designated place, a chair in your den, overlooking the backyard, or at your kitchen table with a cup of coffee before the kids wake up, or a side chair in your office, or the front seat of your pickup truck during your lunch hour. But find your chair where you will meet with God in His Word every day. And if you're not a reader, you can get the audio version. There's all kinds of resources out there. If you don't want to lug a big book around, download the YouVersion app. And if you need some suggestions on where to start, you can either go to Luke or John, like I mentioned above, or just use a reading plan. We have one that goes along with our messages every week over at whoisgrace.com/read or on our app at Grace Church. It'll give you a passage to read and then a few questions to consider. It's really just a fantastic tool to help you along in your discipline of exploration. But there's a second life-changing discipline that I want you to see. It's the discipline of imitation. And this just says, I will emulate the practices of Jesus. I love this quote by Dallas Willard. He said, we can become like Christ by doing one thing, by following Him in the overall style of life He chose for Himself. If we have faith in Christ, we must believe that He knew how to live. And we can, through faith and grace, become like Christ by practicing the types of activities He engaged in, by arranging our whole lives around the activities He Himself practiced in order to remain constantly at home in the fellowship of the Father. You see, once we investigate the ways of Jesus, you can begin to pattern your life around His life. This was exactly what Jesus had in mind with His disciples. Jesus was a rabbi, remember, a teacher. And so He said these words in Luke 6:40. He said, a student is not above his teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. And so you see, one of the great misconceptions about Christianity is that it's simply a doctrine to be believed. Like if you just believe these seven statements, boom, you're a Christian. But Christianity is not just a set of doctrines you believe, but a pattern of life that you live. Listen to how Jesus described it to His disciples and to us. It's an invitation into His lifestyle. He said these words. He said, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And so like every rabbi in Jesus' day, Jesus had two things. First, He had a yoke. Those of us who don't live in a farming society, we need some help with this. So imagine two oxen yoked together to pull a cart or to plow a field. A yoke is that wooden instrument that connects them together. It's how you would share the weight or the force of a load. And so for a rabbi, his yoke, what was called his yoke, was another word for his teachings, his way of reading the Torah. It was his approach to being human, how one should shoulder the weight of life. Shoulder the weight of marriage or divorce or prayer or money or sex or conflict resolution or how to interact with the government. All of it. What made Jesus unique wasn't that He had a yoke. All rabbis had a yoke. It was that He said His yoke was easy. We're going to come back to that in a moment. But secondly, Jesus also had apprentices. And the Hebrew word is talmidim. We say disciples, but maybe a better word would be apprentices. And so to be one of Jesus' talmidim is to apprentice under Jesus. So think about what do you do if you're an apprentice to an electrician or a waitress? You spend time with the trainer. You learn to do the things that he or she does. And eventually, when they're not there anymore, you try to do what he or she would do if they were there in your place. And so to follow Jesus, to be an apprentice means to discipline yourself, to pattern your way of life after his way of life, to learn to live like he lived, to practice the things he practiced, to adopt his lifestyle, to take his yoke upon you. Now, the irony here is that Jesus, this yoke that he called, or that he talked about, he said his yoke was light, and he gave his apprentices the yoke as a solution to the problem of them needing rest. And so it's actually a work instrument, and this is the irony. This was an instrument used in plowing fields, and a work instrument seems to be what exhausted people need the least. Like we think, well, they need a nap, or they need a trip to Cancun. Anything but a yoke. But Jesus realizes, listen, that the most restful gift that he can give those people who are tired is a new way to carry their life, a fresh way to bear responsibilities. He realizes that life is a series of burdens. We can't get away from that. But instead of offering an escape, like, you know, a Netflix show to binge or a spa day, Jesus offers us equipment, but it's equipment that is going to, listen, connect us intimately to him. And so his invitation to take up his yoke is an invitation to travel through life at his side, learning to shoulder the weight of life with ease, to step out of our screen time, consumer-driven society to a life of soul rest. Where I go, he goes. Where he goes, I go. A constant companion and friend. But the yoke comes with an interesting catch. Like, if you want to experience the life of Jesus, you have to adopt the lifestyle of Jesus. This from great insight from this book by John Mark Comer, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. He says that your life is simply a byproduct of your lifestyle. And by lifestyle, he means the rhythms and routines that make up your day-to-day existence. It's the disciplines we're talking about today. It's the way you organize your time. It's the way you spend your money, leverage your energy. You know, there's a saying in business literature that says every system is perfectly designed to get the exact results it is getting. Well, that's not just true of HR best practices and assembly lines. It's true of your life as well. And so if the results you're getting with your life are lousy, like anxiety is at a constant simmer, mild depression is a close friend, high levels of stress, chronic emotional burnout, toxic relationships, little to no sense of the presence of God, then the odds are good that there is something about the system of your life that is off kilter. The rhythms and routines are wrong. The way you've organized your morning or evening, your schedule, your budget, your relationship to your phone, how you manage your resources of time and money and attention, something's out of whack. And so the discipline of imitation says that we learn from Jesus a simple set of practices. Things like building in rhythms of silence and solitude and simplicity and Sabbath, all the S's. But there are two that I want to highlight as we consider imitating Jesus. He showed us, one, how important it is to live in community with other people. Like at every turn, he was living his life with people. His whole strategy to change the world was done with his inner circle of three friends, and then his 12 disciples, and then the 72 that he sent out, and then the 120 that he built the church around. Jesus functioned within these circles of relationships, circles of community. And we like to say life change happens best in circles and not rows. And so even in our physically distanced reality, it is so critical for us to find relationships and live in community. And here at Grace, we're going to provide many opportunities in the coming weeks for you to find a fantastic life group. So keep your eyes open for those. But the other critical practice that I want to point out that Jesus gave us to emulate is his ability to prioritize prayer. Listen to this passage in Luke 5. It says, "Yet the news about him spread all the more, so that crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sickness. But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed." Did you ever think, why did Jesus have to pray? Like, he was God after all. I think that he was often praying as an example to us. He was showing us a proper rhythm of life. Live, pray, live, pray, live, pray. There's this behind-the-scenes strengthening that happens so that our public life can be properly fueled by our private prayer life. And people get geeked out about prayer. Some of you are doing it right now. Do I have to pray at certain times? Do I have to have a prayer rug? Do I need to face east? No, that's a totally different team. Here's how our team works. But Paul says that we can cry out. He uses this word, Abba, Father. It's a word that means daddy. Right? So that this means our prayers should be respectful, but they don't need to be formal. He's our dad. Talk to him like you talk to a dad. I don't know about you, but my kids don't come to me and say, Father, I know thou art busy, but might I beseech thee of a drive to practice or whatever. No, I'm their dad. It's respectful, but it's casual. And prayer is the same way. It's simply talking to God. And it can be out loud or silent. It can be journaling or songwriting or poetry. It also involves listening to God. And guys, Jesus didn't have a less busy life than us. Did you hear that verse? He had crowds. He had paparazzi everywhere. He even had people trying to kill him. I bet you don't have people trying to kill you. Yet his life was consumed with prayer. He prayed daily. He prayed before meals. He retreated to private places to pray. He prayed in public. He prayed in the early morning. He prayed at night. He prayed before big decisions. He prayed for himself. He prayed for others. Jesus prayed. And so one of the disciplines of imitation that we want to emulate is prayer, because Jesus prayed. And so, three life-changing disciplines: exploration, to investigate the ways of Jesus; imitation, to emulate the practices of Jesus; and third is the discipline of action that just says, I will be the hands and feet of Jesus. This discipline will begin to develop as the other two take shape. But it's important to note here that Jesus isn't like other religious leaders who just told his followers what to do and then died. Jesus not only told us what to do, he then showed us with his life what to do. But he not only showed us with his life what to do, he then said, I'm going to send my spirit to do it with you. And so you can do your life, you can do these actions in my power. And guys, what if through his Holy Spirit, Jesus not only came to die on the cross so that all of our sins could be forgiven and so that we could be with God in heaven, but what if he really is available here and now? Like right now, what if life with God, God's presence, God's power really is available to you right now? Because it is. And if that's true, then we can attempt great things in his name. We can do great things for others. One of my favorite quotes is from William Carey, the father of modern missions, who said, expect great things from God and attempt great things for God. This is such a great call for us to serve others. You know, Jesus said to his followers in Matthew 20, whoever wants to be great in my kingdom, here's the ticket to greatness. You guys ready? You'll be a servant of everyone. You'll be my hands and feet. That's what greatness looks like. And we've seen this so much recently around Grace, guys. I couldn't be more proud. That the outcomes of our Hope for 2021 initiative during December were staggering. Hundreds and hundreds of coats for the people of Erie who are cold. Thousands and thousands of diapers for parents who are struggling financially. We overwhelmed 91 foster children with Christmas that they will never forget. We also set up a special fund for local workers in different industries who were deeply affected by COVID shutdowns. We helped St. Martin Center to provide 300 Thanksgiving meals and gifts to new Americans during this difficult year. You guys blew us away in your response to these things. What is that? It's the discipline of action, being the hands and feet of Jesus. So what's the goal of life? It's to be like Jesus. And when we commit to a plan, when we commit to putting some disciplines in place, some practices in place, all of a sudden, we will start to come alive. Jesus calls to us, he says, follow me, and I'm gonna make you fishers. I'm gonna make you what you are not yet, but you could be. Like that person that you long to be inside, the person you were made to be. And so guys, I want to encourage you today to take a step forward in your journey toward Christ-likeness. You don't have to do everything that I mentioned today, but do something. Whether it's exploration, like to start your week with church or to find your chair, or if it's imitation, to live in community or to prioritize prayer, or if it's action, finding a way to serve others. But listen, when we talk about these disciplines, these practices, it really is about putting a plan in place and then entering into a process that resembles training. Like there are these running programs out there. Have you seen these called Couch to 5K? It's a plan that literally takes you from sitting on your couch to running a 5K, because most people couldn't just hop up and go outside and run 5K without some training. In the same way, your Couch to Christ-likeness journey begins with a starting place. And so here's my next step today. It's simply this, is to choose one area of discipline and create a plan around that area. I've put a little suggestion guide together with some resources for each of these disciplines that you can find over at whoisgrace.com/read. But would you start 2021 off with a bang? Would you start living on purpose? Would you put some spiritual disciplines in place and enter into training? It won't work to just grit your teeth and try harder. I remember one time I was preaching and I called someone up out of the crowd, up onto the stage during church, and I sat them at a piano bench and asked them to play on the piano one of the worship songs from that day that we had just sung. This person was not musical at all, and so it was really bad, but they humored me and they kind of banged on some of the keys. And I really startled him when after his first attempt at playing, I just started yelling in his ear, "Try harder!" And I was just making the point that this is the approach that many of us take in our efforts toward Christlikeness. But it's not a matter of trying. It's a matter of training. Like, he could have probably trained himself over time, give him like 6 months or so to play those worship songs. If he would have buckled down and focused and done it, he could have done it. But no amount of trying in that moment was going to make him play those songs. See, training is what allows you to eventually do what you're not able to do right now. And listen, you're not just going to wake up tomorrow and say, "Today, I'm going to show unlimited patience and compassion to my kids." You're not going to do that. Just like you can't wake up and say, "Today, I'm going to run a marathon." Both of those things need training. They need preparation. Practice is essential. And so Jesus's life is filled with these practices that he habitually did. Learning to think and feel and act like Jesus, for you and me, is at least as demanding as learning to run a marathon or to play a piano. And just like those other endeavors, it means to arrange your life around certain exercises and experiences and disciplines that'll enable you to do eventually what you're not yet able to do. Jesus modeled many of these other disciplines in his life. He modeled fasting and simplicity and service and worship and silence and meditation. His life was filled with these disciplines. And as we continue to grow, we must continue to incorporate more and more of these things into our lives. How do I become more compassionate? Time with God, learning his heart, listening to the voice of his spirit. How am I going to put aside lust and anger? Time with God, learning his heart, listening to depend on his spirit. You know, we enter into training, we make a plan, we practice some disciplines, we begin to become more and more like Jesus. And guys, I hate to break it to you, but we're never going to obtain perfection this side of heaven or even close to it. In fact, the best we might ever achieve is even after entering training, we'll sound like playing chopsticks on that piano compared to God. But remember, I want you to remember this important picture that I'm going to close with. There's a story that's been around for decades. It's probably an urban legend kind of story. It's not really documented well, but I want to leave it with you at this point. It's a story about a world-renowned concert pianist. Like, the way the story goes, he's doing a concert at a big concert hall, and this mom had brought her little 9-year-old son to the concert. She was trying to get him inspired for his piano lessons. And so the little boy thought, you know, that piano up on that stage looks pretty cool. And so when his mom wasn't paying attention, the little boy slipped up and he walked onto the stage. He sat down at the bench and he started to play Chopsticks on the piano. And at first the crowd chuckled, but then they started to get angry and uncomfortable. Chopsticks is irritating. They were waiting for the great maestro to come out and play. And they were wondering in their head, what's wrong with this kid's parents? Everybody's wondering, what's the great pianist going to do? How is the maestro going to respond when somebody's messing up his concert by playing Chopsticks? The crowd thought security would surely come at any moment and get rid of this kid since the parents were doing nothing. But instead of security, the great maestro himself came walking out onto the stage. And instead of getting mad, he went up to the piano. And he put both arms around the boy on the keyboard and he started to improvise so that they were now playing a duet together. And the way the story goes that while playing, the great musician whispered these words of encouragement into the child's ear. He whispered the whole time, "I'll get you for this, you little brat." No, that wasn't it. I'm kidding. He whispered. He said, "Just keep going. Just don't quit. Like, you keep playing and I'll keep playing and we're going to do something that no one will ever forget." And he was right. By the time the night was over, he had played all his greatest hits, but the moment no one would ever forget was the duet playing Chopsticks with the 9-year-old punk kid, where the maestro took the kid's mess and he turned it into something unforgettable, a masterpiece. You and I are never going to be just like Jesus, but by leaning into these life-giving disciplines and with God's help, your mess can become a beautiful masterpiece. I love you guys. We'll see you next week.